It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. On the show today, navigating uncertainty.
I kind of think uncertainty is a perennial human experience. It's one that we're terrified of, but that we experience constantly. And right now is a moment of extreme uncertainty.
This is psychology professor Jamil Zaki.
And cynicism is a sort of dark safety.
Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, when the world is uncertain, we can feel totally out in the open. We can feel deeply unsafe. And so how do you recover a sense of control in a world that you fundamentally can't control? One way is to prejudge it and to prejudge everybody in it. And so a cynic, by deciding that they can't trust anybody, by deciding that people are generally rotten, they might not live in a very bright and happy world, but they live in one that they understand. They feel as though they can predict the future. They feel as though they understand all the people around them, and that at least gives them some semblance of control over a chaotic life.
Jamil's interest in cynicism is part of his larger focus on the brain and human behavior.
I study how people connect with one another, why it can be hard to connect, and how we can try to get a little bit better at it.
At Stanford University's Social Neuroscience Lab, Jamil measures the seemingly immeasurable qualities like goodness, kindness, and empathy. His goal is to experiment, document, and ultimately encourage these behaviors. And yet Jamil openly admits that his recent research into cynicism is very personal.
I've been a secret cynic for almost my entire life. And a lot of people are surprised to hear that because I study, in essence, human goodness. But there's this phrase in psychology that research is me-search. The assumption that whatever you do, you must also be.
And during the pandemic, Jamil says he hit a bit of a breaking point.
Yeah, 2020 and 2021 was probably among the most cynical times of my life. I think a lot of us felt really stuck in our homes, and we were experiencing humanity more than ever through our screens. And it turns out that it's very easy to feel cynical when your representations of other people are media representations, because a lot of media presents us with really terrifying, awful views of who other people are, especially people who are different from ourselves. And also, that year in late 2020, a good friend of mine unfortunately passed away from brain cancer. He was a neuroscientist who also studied empathy. And he was also one of my heroes. His name was Emile Bruneau, and he was one of the most optimistic and hopeful people I ever knew. And losing him, I felt, was sort of like losing his worldview. He so fundamentally believed in human goodness. And when he died, I felt this sense that I had lost the ability to see things the way that he saw them. That was sort of, frankly, a little bit of a rock bottom for my own cynicism that made me think, gosh, I can't keep on living this way. And furthermore, if I, a scientist who studies human goodness, is having trouble seeing it, how is everybody else doing?
Yeah, not good.
And it turned out not that great. And that what I was going through was something that so many of us were going through. And that's what made me want to start thinking systematically about this problem and what we can do about it. Cynicism, the notion that humanity is greedy, selfish, and dishonest.
Here's Jamil Zaki on the TED stage.
In 1972, 45% of Americans thought that most people can be trusted. By 2018, that had dropped to about 30%. We are living through a cynicism epidemic. But here's the thing. You might think that cynicism is a system upgrade that allows us to see who we really are. It's not. It traps us in a version of the world we don't want to live in, and one we don't have to. One of my favorite studies of all time occurred in southeastern Brazil. Two fishing villages there are separated by just 30 miles. One sits by the ocean, where fishing requires large boats and heavy equipment. To make a living there, fishermen must work together. The other sits by a lake, where fishermen strike out alone on small boats and compete with one another. Years ago, researchers tested how people in each of these villages responded to a set of social experiments. Ocean fishermen trusted strangers and cooperated with their neighbors. Lake fishermen competed and mistrusted instead. But here's the crazy part. These folks didn't start out any different from each other. But the longer fishermen worked on the lake, the more they competed. The longer they worked on the ocean, the less they did. Some families, schools, and companies are like ocean villages. People trust because they know others will earn it. Some are like lake towns. People look out for themselves because no one else will. Our social worlds shape us, like clay, into hopeful or cynical versions of ourselves. And right now, many of us are living in a lake town of historic proportion.
Taking the fishing villages as sort of a metaphor, do you see that those two sort of approaches in different pockets of the United States?
Absolutely. One big factor here is economic inequality. So more unequal states within the U.S., for instance, experience lower trust. Because when people feel as though resources are all grabbed up by a small percentage of people, they might feel like they really need to compete in order to be those people, in order to climb over everybody else. So that's one factor. Another is just the way that we've started to count everything about our lives. My colleague here at Stanford, Anna Lemke, says that whatever you can quantify can become an addiction. How many steps we take, how well we sleep, how much approval our opinions get on social media, and all of those become vectors for competition, comparison, and for cynicism too.
One of the things you say, though, is that people love a cynic. And I'm curious as to why you'd say that.
Our culture has glamorized gloom in a couple of different ways. One thing is that cynics appear smart to many people. This is what psychologists call the cynical genius illusion. So if you tell people a story about one person who's very cynical and doesn't trust anybody, and another person who's really open and trusting, and you ask, which one of these two people would do better on a series of tasks? 70% of people think that cynics will outperform non-cynics on cognitive tasks, that they're smarter. And 85% of people think that cynics are socially smarter, for instance, better able to tell who's lying and who's telling the truth. In other words, most of us put faith in people who don't have faith in people, which is a bit of a tongue twister, but it's true, and we're wrong. It turns out that cynics do less well than non-cynics on cognitive tests. They're worse at knowing who's lying and who's telling the truth because they assume that everybody's on the take and so stop paying attention to the evidence.
And this impacts your health too.
Yes. Cynics, they're physically less healthy. They suffer from more heart disease. They die younger than non-cynics. They're psychologically less healthy, suffering from more depression, loneliness, and anxiety. And they're socially less healthy, having shorter and less satisfying relationships. There's one study that I find so poignant and sad. Researchers brought people into the lab and had them give a speech on a topic that they didn't know they were going to talk about, which would make anybody nervous, and it increases people's blood pressure. Some of these folks were given a cheerleader. I mean, not literally, but a person who was with them who said, I know you can do this, you've got this, just kind of encouraged and supported them, and others didn't. And what these researchers found is that for most people, having someone supportive around lowered their blood pressure. But if you were a cynic, it didn't lower your blood pressure.
Oh.
You know, I think that social contact, togetherness, is like a form of psychological nourishment. And if that's true, then cynicism makes it harder to metabolize the calories of social life, to receive nourishment from the people around us, which is tragic because that's a huge part of what makes life beautiful and meaningful. So, cynicism might not be as smart as you think it is, but it's still powerful because our stories about each other become self-fulfilling. Cynics are more likely to refuse intimacy and cooperation. They hurt others to avoid being hurt. They tend to spy on their colleagues and suspect their friends, and other people unsurprisingly react badly, sometimes acting selfishly in response. In other words, by mistreating others, cynics create the exact conditions they fear. They tell a story full of villains and end up living in it. I call this the cynicism trap, and my lab explores ways that people fall into it. In one study, we asked people how happiness works. Some thought that it's a zero-sum game, meaning that as one person's happiness goes up, another person's must go down. Now, they're wrong. It turns out that when we act generously towards others, that tends to increase our happiness. But cynics acted on their illusion. When given chances to help strangers, they were less likely to do so. They ended up less happy as well. By hoarding well-being, they lost out on one of its key ingredients, other people.
It's not just that people are trustworthy or not trustworthy. It's that when we trust them, they reciprocate. This is what's called earned trust. The idea is, if you have low expectations of somebody, they know, they can tell. It comes through in the way that you behave, and people don't like that, and they retaliate. So if you treat somebody like they're not trustworthy, they actually become less trustworthy. You create this toxic, self-fulfilling prophecy. The good news is that the exact same is true of trust. People are more likely to be trustworthy if you trust them. And that's something that I don't think people realize. We act as though trusting others is a sort of weakness. Like we've shown our belly, we've made ourselves vulnerable. In fact, it's a gift that we give to other people that can change them for the better, and a gift that they often repay.
Cynicism doesn't help us see reality more clearly, but it does change reality, poisoning our relationships, our lives, and our culture. It is not a system upgrade. It's mental malware. But we don't have to accept it. In one study, we changed how people thought about empathy in politics. Some people were randomly chosen to read a cynical essay. It began, and I'm paraphrasing, "You might think that empathy is a weakness that will make you lose every argument, and you'd be right." Afterwards, we asked these folks to write a note about gun control to someone they disagreed with, and they sniped at each other. Here's a voice actor reading what one Democrat wrote to a Republican.
"It's hard not to state this bluntly. You should be in favor of stricter gun laws because you should care about the lives of other people more than your outdated feelings of machismo."
And here's a Republican writing to a Democrat.
"People need to know they are able to have the freedom to bear arms in order to protect themselves. You Democrats don't get to take that away from us."
Basically, we recreated Twitter by accident. Other people read a different essay. It began, "You might think empathy is a weakness that will make you lose every argument, and you'd be wrong," and went on to describe empathy as a strength in politics. Again, we asked these folks to write to an opponent about gun control, but this time things changed. Here's a Democrat.
"There are some common sense regulations that we should implement to keep people safe. We all want what is best for the country, and there are things we can meet in the middle on to tackle the issue of gun violence."
And a Republican.
"Horrible crimes can be committed using guns. Everything from school shootings to murders because of racism and white supremacy. It's very understandable that you think it makes sense to make gun laws more strict. We're all reasonable people and we just want what's best for our loved ones."
To us, this was wild. Remember, just like ocean and lake fishermen, these people did not start out any different. But just reading one essay turned some of them into new optimists and others into new cynics. We taught these people that empathy was useful, they used it, and it became useful. This is what I want you to remember and what I want you to know. That if cynical stories can become self-fulfilling, our work shows that hopeful ones can as well.
The evidence is really clear that people on each side, Democrats and Republicans, are dead wrong about their adversaries, about their opponents. When asked to imagine the average person they disagree with, people on both sides imagine somebody who is way more extreme, twice as hateful, twice as anti-democratic, and four times as violent as the truth. We're really fighting phantoms in a way, and as we draw further apart from one another, we don't get the evidence, the data from real conversations to know that actually people we disagree with first of all, are still people, and second, that they're probably more reasonable and peaceful and open-minded than we think they are.
This gets us really to your prescription for overcoming cynicism. It is what you call hopeful skepticism. Please explain that idea.
Yeah, let's take the two pieces of hopeful skepticism one at a time. Skepticism is often confused with cynicism, but it's really quite different. If cynicism is a lack of faith in people, skepticism is a lack of faith in our assumptions. Skeptics think like scientists, and they don't imagine or assume that people are great or that people are terrible. They wait for evidence to figure out who they can trust and who they can believe in. And because of that, they learn more quickly and are able to adapt to new situations. Hope is often confused with optimism, and it's not. Hope is the idea that things could get better, that we don't know what the future holds. And because of that, our actions matter. I am a big fan of putting these two perspectives together. I think that both hope and skepticism are a form of mastering uncertainty. So a hopeful skeptic to me is not somebody who is naive, not somebody who thinks that things are great or will be great, but rather someone who's open to learning about what people are really like and using that common ground to try to craft a future that more of us want.
So what do you say to those people when they say, oh, Jamil, so positive?
I say, if you could only see inside my mind, you would not accuse me of being too positive. I think about one of my favorite terms for, I guess, what I would think of as a fierce sort of hope comes from Martin Luther King Jr. In 1967, he spoke to the American Psychological Association, and he was much more diplomatic about it, so I'm paraphrasing here, but he in essence said, you all are so obsessed with people being positive and happy and well-adjusted, and why should we be adjusted to a world of bigotry and violence and inequality? We should not be adjusted. He said, I think that what we should focus on is creative maladjustment. We should absolutely reject a status quo that is unjust, but we should be creative in knowing that something better is possible and that a lot of people want that better outcome. That, to me, is a perfect encapsulation of hopeful skepticism. It is not the same as saying things are great. It is writing down that list of all the things that are terrible, but also acknowledging that many, many people around us want things to improve. And in that, there is power. In that collective will, there is great power to produce change.
That's Jamil Zaki. He's a professor of psychology at Stanford University and lead investigator at its social neuroscience lab. You can watch his full talk at ted.npr.org. On the show today, Navigating Uncertainty. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. We'll be right back.